As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Whale Hunting Podcast, where we shine a light onto hidden worlds of money and power. I'm Tom Wright, and this week I'm joined by Daniel Levin, a lawyer turned hostage negotiator and conflict resolution advisor. We're always telling you that whale hunting takes you inside how the world really works. And Daniel is a person who really lives in the deep state world, I would call it. Welcome, Daniel.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Tom.
So your formal title is you are the director or the founder of the Liechtenstein Foundation for State Governance. But what you really do is you train people in authoritarian states to try to nurture democracy. And through that, you've also become a kind of, well, it's called a track three diplomat, somebody who helps solve crises that can't be solved in the more formal world of diplomacy. So tell us a little bit about how you entered this world of informal diplomacy.
Sure, gladly. In 2008, I started negotiations with the princely family in Liechtenstein. We had developed a platform that was a form of e-government, essentially, in the late 90s to work in countries that really had been destroyed either by civil war or natural disasters all over the world. And rather than bring in McKinsey or World Bank people or LSE people to tell the Democratic Republic of Congo, or at the time Zaire, how to rebuild their country or create parliamentary democracies, what we did is we spent a few years developing a best practices, modular form of economic reform, and then licensed it to those countries and trained next generation young people to use it. That was in the late 90s. Africa, Southern Africa was emerging, Eastern Europe was emerging, obviously, in terms of major political upheaval. And that approach of, rather than bringing in outside experts, was a novel way of dealing first with economic reform, then political reforms. And before I even did that kind of work and was a corporate lawyer, my initial beginning was in academia, dealing with conflicts between secular and religious legal systems. And so it prepared me well for trying to figure out solutions within legal systems, within societies that did things differently for tribal reasons, religious reasons, and so on. The princely family found this approach interesting and decided to start a foundation, the Liechtenstein Foundation for State Governance, based on that, which is developing modules to allow countries that are emerging from civil war or will emerge from civil war, identify next generation leaders and train them, give them the tools to actually succeed, whether that's in politics, in military, in civil society. And that was the origin of this approach. That then led to engagements in conflict zones such as Syria, which in turn led to very quiet, behind the scenes, what you call track three diplomacy, in trying to bring initially sides to the table that wouldn't otherwise be able to talk even indirectly. And then that in turn led to hostage negotiations and other forms of de-escalation.
Well, that brings us to your fabulous book, Proof of Life, from a couple of years ago, which is about the incredible story of how you were drawn into attempts to find an American, young American, who'd been taken hostage in Syria during the conflict there. So tell us about how hostage negotiations really work and what you've learned about trying to get people back from these regimes.
There's no one way to answer that. There are common denominators in terms of how they don't work, which is the super public, social media driven, microphone driven type of hostage negotiations that never end well. The real negotiations happen quietly below the surface. That's true whether you're dealing with someone being detained by a terrorist group or by a drug cartel in Mexico, or whether that someone being wrongfully detained by the Chinese government. The ways to get hostages released have to happen really quietly behind the scenes, not so much only because this thing dies when it's being made public, but also because the two sides rarely have what it takes to make a deal happen. That's true for any form of diplomacy, also superpower diplomacy. We have this idea that a problem can be solved directly in that problem, when in fact you really need some form of scale diplomacy, meaning before you even get to hostages, you take U.S.-China negotiations over South China Sea issues, over Taiwan, over North Korea. On a singular level, these issues cannot be resolved. The only way they can be resolved is by thinking of it as two scales that you can balance out until you have an equilibrium between the points that each side cares about. Same thing is true for hostage negotiations. So if you have an American who's being held by, let's say, the Nusra rebels in Syria or ISIS, you can't just go in and give what it is that the group that's holding the hostage wants, because it's a little more complicated than that. Also, in fact, because you're not really allowed to give them, especially compensation. You have to start doing it indirectly. There may be another group that has something of value and you can compensate that group. Or it may be that the mother of a hostage taker requires chemotherapy for breast cancer, and you can arrange for that in Germany. You start to have a network of favors and counter favors that works. That, of course, becomes infinitely more difficult when you either have many, many hostages, like you have right now in Gaza, following October 7th, or when you have something that's being played out in public, such as journalists who are being wrongfully detained. That becomes more difficult because it is so hard to do something quietly below the scenes. When you're dealing with an armed group that holds a hostage, it is far easier to quietly reach an arrangement on what it is that you can do, what favors and counterfavors, what balance you can give. First of all, to just get information on the hostage, whether the hostage is still alive or not. Those are all steps, interim steps, prior to any kind of release. The release itself is a very fraught and complicated process itself. So there's so many elements to that that have to happen below the surface, away from cameras and microphones, executed by people you've never heard of and will never hear of, for something like that to really be successful.
So when it's an armed rebel group, you're saying it's easier, the sovereign state, a superpower, to reach some sort of agreement when that's the dynamic?
It does, because what happens with a, let's say, an armed group in Syria or in Yemen or in Libya or a drug cartel that holds someone is ultimately, it's not even just when it's not only about negotiating the price, you can actually sit down and have a reasonable direct or indirect negotiation over what it is that someone needs. There are certain rules you have to follow. For example, you never ask a question if you don't know the answer, right? Like any good lawyer. So you cannot just go to a hostage taker and say, what would it take? Because if they ask you for something that you can't do, you basically signed a death sentence. It's a very nuanced approach to getting the information you need before you even ask the question. By the time you ask the question, you have to know that you can actually satisfy the person making the request. The problem with a wrongfully detained journalists, aid workers, even diplomats in countries all over the world is there's a very, very small window where you could reach an agreement before this thing went to the courts. Once it starts going to the courts, the country detaining the person starts to suddenly act like it is a law-abiding country, in the sense that the legal process has to play out and there has to be a conviction, and then the president can ride in on a white horse and declare him amnesty as part of a hostage swap. But that can be years down the road. It has happened. It has happened with people wrongfully detained. We got involved with someone wrongfully detained in Russia and also in China. And before it ever was made public, within 5 days, you can effect a release there. If you miss that window, now it gets much, much harder. And it's that at that moment, your track three efforts move, for example, to getting information on the person detained, to getting medication to the person detained. So it really depends on what stage you're at. But this is what makes the official process so difficult.
What you're saying is once it gets into the media and into the courts, then it becomes a much more knotty problem.
Yeah. So when that window closed, the efforts move away from negotiating a release to accelerating the release, meaning trying to reduce that time period. You can start negotiating the penalty and the performance of the legal process, as well as the safety of the hostage.
And then when you're dealing, of course, with the insurgent groups, the risks are even higher, aren't they? Because that's when you get the beheadings, like James Foley. I think it was a decade ago now, he was tragically beheaded in Syria. And then, of course, your own involvement with the hostage negotiation for your book, Proof of Life. When you're not dealing with a government, however sort of outside the lines the government is acting, the insurgent groups are much worse and the stakes are often a lot higher, which is death, right?
They are. They're much higher. There's an element of, in the case, obviously, of James Foley and Stephen Sotloff and then Kayla Muller, who was executed in early 2015. It was the fall of 2014 and early 15 were particularly gruesome. It was also the time that the events in my book take place. The problem that you had there is that ISIS at the time took hostages for the shock value of their execution, and they treated it as a recruitment method. And there was basically in the same way with that, if you recall, the Jordanian fighter pilot who was captured and then burnt alive in a sort of a staged, terrible, terrible video and disseminated all over the world. That's something that's almost impossible to intervene in. It's quite rare, I will say, even in Afghanistan, in Yemen, in Libya, it's quite rare that people get taken hostages just for the shock value of the execution. But the fall of 2014 was a terrible time, a really terrible time from that perspective. And sometimes the hardest things for us to do is to really, unfortunately, talk to parents and say that there's really nothing we can do. It would be misleading to claim that we can help when we can't. So that happens. It's terrible. The hardest, the families and the relationships that stick with me are not the hostages that get out. They get on to their lives, and I rarely have anything to do with them afterwards. Again, the relationships that stick with me and that keep me up are the ones that never get out, where we actually failed. And in fact, in my book, I chose to write about a case where I was unable to help, actually. So it is far more impactful on our lives when we failed than in the ones that we got out.
Yeah, you should go read Proof of Life. It's a fantastic book and shows how these kinds of fraught negotiations happen, and with Daniel at the center of it. So Daniel, you work a lot in Libya and in Yemen. And the idea is there that with your foundation in Liechtenstein, you want to train people in those countries so that they don't become failed states. I mean, you could argue Yemen is a sort of a failed state. Libya is getting a little bit better, right? But the idea is that these places don't become the next Afghanistan or a place where terrorists can operate from. I mean, that's the bigger picture of all of this. So where are efforts in those two countries, and what's the prognosis?
At the risk of getting a little wonkish, but just to do justice to your question, you don't go to those places and just negotiate peace agreements in a civil war. That's just not meaningful. Those countries are complicated countries. Many a leader has, you know, lost his career and his future over Yemen. Nasser, you know, was the beginning of Nasser's end in the 50s when he tried to get active in Yemen. So that's not new.
Sorry to break in, but also obviously Mohammed bin Salman in Yemen has not been successful either.
And Mohammed bin Zayed either, the Emirati leader too. So yeah, Yemen has been a disaster for anyone who's touched it, as is Lebanon, as many other, Afghanistan and so on. So, and it's not because there's something inherently wrong with those countries. It's just that you have countries with very tribal structures. Yemen, for example, is about 180 tribes. The idea that you can just come with a Danish style or American style or Swiss style or British style kind of democracy, forgetting the hubris of thinking those democracies are so worth copying for a moment, the idea that you can just copy paste them into a country like Yemen or Libya is simply silly. So our approach of the foundation is not just to identify young future leaders. The idea is not just to teach people, it's terribly patronizing, but rather to work with them on approaches that work for their country. Let me give you an example. In Libya now, we're working on a model, a parliamentary model, that is based not just on having a one or two chamber system, but rather having the popular chamber be composed to a large extent, perhaps even 50%, on a sortition-based so it's like a jury trial. The idea that people are not voted for half of that parliament, but rather get to participate in a rotation system so that you really have a full representation of the population. Last time that was actually tried was in the Middle Ages with the selection of the Doge of Venice. So we don't have modern examples, but what it does is it leads to much higher education levels because people suddenly feel like they have a responsibility of being involved. Same thing with Yemen. How do you create a national identity in Yemen where people define themselves by belonging to a tribe, not to a national country? How do you create a national entity? And how do you do that? Is it a confederation system? What kind of a constitution really works for that? What are council of elders? How do you create a rule of law? How do we select judges? So those are important questions. You cannot just come in and say, adopt Western-style liberal democracies, develop it on the ground. So the idea of the concept of the foundation is work internally with people on the ground to work towards those kinds of solutions. And that's been a fascinating process. Libya, Yemen as examples, they're hard because obviously you're doing it in a country where there is an awful lot of violence. It's difficult to travel. It is very, very challenging to do that, but that is the point. And to do it, rather than flying in experts from the outside, to try and select people on the ground. The networks we develop as a result of that work on the ground are also the networks that help us then also mediate in conflicts or even be active in hostage situations. It's not some separate skill. It's that kind of network that allows you both the reach and the access to the people and also the local sensitivities then.
Fascinating. Well, obviously, one of the biggest conflicts in the world right now is the war in Gaza. You yourself were born in Israel, grew up in Switzerland, but then served in the Israeli Defense Forces, I think in the first Intifada in the early 90s or in 1990, right? So you've got given all the work you've done in conflict zones, hostage negotiations, you've got a fantastically interesting view of what's going on over there. And you wrote a piece in The Guardian in February suggesting that one of the potential ways out of what's happening in the Middle East is a federated states solution or a confederated states solution, where you'd have a Israeli state and a Palestinian state, and they would have some sort of free travel, free working between them, but they would remain separate entities, at least for the first part of the plan you put forward. And then you ended up receiving death threats from people in response to that editorial, which just shows you how knotty some of these problems are. So can you talk a bit about what happened after you published that op-ed in The Guardian?
The point of the op-ed was basically to provide a bit of a counterpoint to the performance-based diplomacy that's happening there, which is you have the usual requests for two-state solutions. Some people talk about one-state solutions, which is a binational secular state. And then you have the demonstrations on the right, on the left, from the river to the sea, or it's a homeland to the Jews and there should be no Palestinians. You have all the whole gambit, usually with a healthy dosage of religion sprinkled in there for good measure in order to justify anything that would otherwise not be justifiable. And my point was that if anyone really is interested in ending the bloodshed to stop just this one-sided victimhood, whichever side it may be, whether it's the Jewish-Israeli side, starting with the Holocaust all the way to the wars that Israel was attacked from 48 and so on, and the Palestinian side obviously suffering, certainly since 1967, a permanent occupation that's become more and more violent, more and more vicious ever since. I also wanted to debunk the idea that we really can just keep on talking about two-state solutions without really thinking what that means. Because if you're not going to do that together with real investment, real education, a real future for that population, what you're going to get is this large, open prison, essentially, that you got in Gaza with massive poverty. And this, the point was not to attack one side or condone the actions of one side, but rather say, if we're really going to do that, we have to deal with, obviously, the separation of the people, but also add the aspirational element of a one-state thing, which is talk about a way that a Palestinian in Ramallah still can go visit where his grandparents or great-grandparents came from in Yafo or in Haifa or in Tzfat in the north of Israel, and a Jewish settler who believes that there's biblical value in living on some hill in an outpost in the West Bank can do so too. It's just that you can only vote in your country. And I didn't really expect anyone to think that this is a polemic postulate, because in fact, you have examples where that works. The Israeli healthcare system would collapse without Palestinian nurses and doctors who commute every day from the West Bank. So there are examples if you want to make it work, rather than just keep on talking about the silly empty two-state idea. And what surprised me was that I got threats, including death threats, actually from many sides, but the most perhaps unsurprising, but still the most personal and hurtful ones came from a far-right Israeli side that treated it essentially like a dirty dog syndrome, which is that you're betraying your own by thinking that we will ever give up permanently the aspirations to the full biblical homeland, which, depending on how zealous someone is, can be from Damascus to Alexandria, it can be from Baghdad to Alexandria. It obviously gets, I'm not trying to be silly about it, but I really got threats, including people who sent me just messages through foundation email, through my author's website, just with my home address or with the names of my kids and so on. So it just shows how vicious this conflict has become, where literally just a suggestion on a methodology for ending it without that kind of one-sided approach, suddenly you're treated as a traitor. It was really quite surprising. What has surprised me too, and I want to add that to this discussion, is I got the most interested responses. You get the usual sort of BBC wants to talk about that and all that, but the most interested responses I got from my Iranian interlocutors. And that's an element, you and I haven't even really had a chance to talk about this, but very surprisingly, the Iranians are starting to view the escalation, Israel and Palestine escalation, as one that could have a contagion effect on them, where their approach towards, you know, destabilizing the Middle East and making themselves relevant through satellite allies in Hezbollah in Lebanon and Assad regime in Syria and the Iraqi militias in Iraq and the Houthis in Yemen. That approach, they're starting to look as having diminishing returns, where they feel they may have reached the high water mark of their influence. And the responses I had from Iranian contacts on this idea of a confederation Palestine is one that they say that's something they might actually cautiously support. Obviously in stages, obviously they want sanctions relief in return. Rather than keep on talking about the nuclear issue, which they view as unreliable because any American president can undo it, they're starting to see this as essentially the ladder that would allow everyone to climb down from the trees, including their own. So that, to me, I found very, very interesting.
So we should say that you've been involved for many, many years with Track 3 diplomacy. And we should just say again, Track 3 diplomacy is under the radar diplomacy, individual diplomacy, rather than involving states. Track 1 would be like the foreign minister. Track 2 would be diplomats and groupings of semi-official people. And Track 3, what you do is really person-to-person, quiet talks. And you've been involved with Iran for a long time through, obviously, the whole Obama's agreement to try to curtail their nuclear program. And then, obviously, Trump pulled out of that in 2018. That's now dead, isn't it? And what you're saying is that's dead. They're not really interested in that because it can be pulled away by any U.S. change of government if it goes back to a Trump administration. But they're interested in other kinds of potential agreements that would also curtail their nuclear program?
Well, the problem from the Iranian perspective on the nuclear discussions is not that they want to use the number of issues. One is their highest leverage point, again, high watermark, is by remaining a threshold state. Obviously, once they cross that, it triggers all kinds of issues, including very likely nuclear escalation with Saudis, who are going to definitely want their own nuclear weapons. It's not something the Iranians really want. The other thing that happens is there are so many mechanisms in place that any agreement they reach on sanction relief, for example, in return for any denuclearization, they don't view as reliable because in 2015, the U.S. Congress passed a law called INARA, the Iran Nuclear Agreement Reduction Act, which means that any agreement that an American president passes with any nuclear context, Congress needs to be able to ratify. In other words, they took that power away from the presidency, and that makes it totally unreliable if you look at the U.S. Congress, which means you don't only have to wait for the next American president to kill it. Your current president could be neutered by his own Congress on that. So what the Iranians are looking at and saying, let's carve out the nuclear issue. We stay in threshold state. What we like to do is get relief on sanctions, economic relief, other de-escalations, and do it through other means. And if those other means mean we could quietly support a concept of confederation, and you have witnessed some distancing between Tehran and Hezbollah, for example. So for them, this idea that they can quietly support this and signal to Palestinian groups and groups within Israel's neighbors that they would support something like that only at a much later phase, to me, that's something that would be criminal not to explore properly.
So that's something that's actually actively getting discussed. That's fascinating to hear what's actually going on in some of this Track 3 stuff. What else, before I let you go, what else is keeping you interested in the Middle East and or elsewhere even?
The idea of these kinds of conversations, always remember how big your fail rate is. So, you know, one of the biggest disappointments we were involved for years was in the DRC, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, before the current president Felix Tshisekedi came to power. There were lots of discussions with him and his team in trying to do that and effect democratic change when he came to power, also through a somewhat unsavory arrangement with his predecessor, Joseph Kabila. We had to pull back. So years of investment into that, you really flush down the toilet because you realize this, if you're not making a difference, if you're just placing one Kabila with another Kabila, essentially, and I know this may sound inflammatory, there are an awful lot of those examples where you have to simply just pack up your tents and go home because you really cannot affect any meaningful change. It's heartbreaking. You have so many of those terribly sad stories too. So one area that the foundation's active and does interest us is in de-escalation between the US and China, whether those are issues of Taiwan. And in many cases, those kinds of de-escalations don't happen because you're really working towards a peace treaty, but rather by doing what we call constitutional diplomacy, which is bringing the parties to the table just through an academic discussion of a constitutional solution, which is a whole lot better than the alternative, which is not being at the table and thinking of resolving these conflicts through military means. So the foundation gets really active in those kinds of areas too. And it's a very wonkish, think tankish approach to sort of think through what kind of constitutional models would work for, let's say, China and Taiwan that could be acceptable to each side, even if there may not be anything that realistically pass in the next years. Sitting at the table with senior representatives is something that's a lot better than the alternative. So sometimes diplomacy, even track three, takes that form of de-escalation that's really not about accomplishing something, but of preventing the deterioration, the further deterioration.
And keeping the conversation going, basically, so that exactly. so those human-to-human contacts are there for when the situations get really bad.
Exactly.
Well, Daniel, it's been fascinating chatting to you as ever. Thanks so much for coming on Whale Hunting. And I would advise our listeners to go and pick up the book, Proof of Life.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure.
That's it for this week. Thanks to Daniel for joining us. You can find out more about Daniel, his books, and his other work at daniellevinauthor.com. That's daniellevinauthor.com. The best way to stay up to date with Whale Hunting is to hit follow wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also subscribe to the Whale Hunting newsletter for updates on the shadowy lives of the powerful and ultra wealthy at whalehunting.projectbrazen.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week for more. Whale Hunting is a production of Project Brazen. It's hosted by me, Tom Wright, and Bradley Hope. It's produced by Megan Dean and Claire Urban. At Project Brazen, Mariangel Gonzalez is our project manager and Megan Dean is network manager. Ryan Ho is the creative director with additional design from Andrea Klarich. For more from Whale Hunting and to subscribe to our newsletter, visit whalehunting.projectbrazen.com.